With populism on the rise, capitalism under attack, and socialism back in vogue, the work of Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek is more relevant than ever. Hayek started his career as a Wunderkind professor, joining the faculty of the London School of Economics in his early 30s, and he was a central figure in the debates that consumed the profession during the Great Depression. He would go on to spend most of his seven-decade-long career as an outsider whose work diverged from the mainstream following the Keynesian revolution of the 1930s and 1940s. Eventually, the world circled back to Hayek's ideas, and he shared the 1974 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Today, Hayek is best known on his enduring insights on emergent order, as a critic of socialism and central planning, and for articulating that all knowledge in society is decentralized, and thus a modern economy relies on the coordinating role of prices and private property in order to function. In his last book, The Fatal Conceit, Hayek attacked the hubris of central planning, writing that the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. Hayek's enormous body of work is the subject of a new book by George Mason University economist Peter Behtke. It takes a deep dive into Hayek's writing and serves as a rousing call for a serious rethinking of libertarian and classical liberal thought. "Liberalism is in need of renewal," writes Behtke, who started his career as an expert on post-communist economics in the former Soviet Union. "Too much time and effort has been put into repackaging and marketing a fixed doctrine of internal truths, rather than rethinking and evolving to meet new challenges. Even Hayek," Behtke notes, "made mistakes late in his career, including having kind words for Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet." Hayek's great legacy is his understanding of economics and liberal political theory as a process for creating a world in which individuals and society could become more free, equal, and prosperous over time. In this recent podcast, I talk with Behtke about the historical and intellectual context of Hayek's thought, the influence of Hayek's mentor Ludwig von Mises on his work, and how his rich opus can help guide libertarians in the 21st century to follow Hayek's dictum that we must make the building of a free society once more an intellectual adventure, a deed of courage. Pete, tell me, you know, what is Hayek's relevance? What is his key relevance and meaning to the 21st century?
What I try to argue in the book is that Hayek had a research program that focused on how alternative institutional arrangements impact the learning and social learning that we engage in as human beings, and that project has not yet been fully exhausted. And so despite the fact that he was writing and contributing things in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. and 70s, they're still very relevant for our day today because his ideas still speak to us.
So, you know, in the book and then later a TV show that came out right at the end of the 20th century, Daniel Yergin and Joseph Stanislaw in a text called The Commanding Heights, The Battle Between Government and the Marketplace That is Remaking the Modern World, they declare the 20th century a battle between the ideas of Friedrich Hayek and John Maynard Keynes, and they said that Hayek won in a rout. Yeah. Is that still true? Rather, let's put that in context, in historical context, because the 20th century was definitely a century of large government growth, and not simply from a left-wing or a right-wing perspective, but business got big, social organization got big. The idea of bigness, whether it was in government or business, was the thing. And Keynes was kind of the prophet of that, or the incarnation of that, that we are smart enough and we can come up with ways to understand things and manage things. Hayek was always pushing against that. And of course, Hayek for most of the 20th century was, or the second half, was kind of declining in prestige and readership and all of that. But then at the end, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and with, you know, even people like, and this is in a crude sense, Bill Clinton at the end of the 20th century saying, you know, the era of big government was over here. Is this still true?
Well, I think there's a little thing called the financial crisis, which, mm-hmm. you know, causes us to rethink. But to be honest with you, it actually goes back much further. And it's, you know, first 9/11. Mm-hmm. And then prior to that, also the globalization and its discontents. And then, you know, prior to that, the difficulties in post-communism. So when Jurgen, did the book, and the TV series, they were mainly focused when they first started doing it, that the book is before the TV series. But when they were really talking about the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what happened with the Cold War. And so they, like Fukuyama, was kind of caught up in the end of history rhetoric and the ultimate victory kind of idea.
And there was this triumphalism,
yeah,
right?
Triumphalism.
That, you know, if there was the free world and the communist world, and one was predicated upon larger and larger institutions that were controlled by fewer and fewer people. What we saw with the collapse of communism, the rise of the internet, really was a decentralized world, or
right,
where people wanted smaller organizations that were closer to home, power, rather than being done remotely, as Stuart Brand talked about in the Whole Earth catalog in the late 60s, but that power and would be a two-way street and would be closer to home. That all seemed to be happening in a big way.
But I think that what happened in the end of history rhetoric is that, mm-hmm, people buy the conclusions, but they don't figure out the analysis that led Hayek to his conclusions.
Right. Well, let's
we have to focus on the analysis, because it's the analysis which allows us to adapt to the changing circumstances of the world. So Hayek is as relevant to the collapse of communism as he is to explaining the global financial crisis.
Okay.
And he is as relevant to the rise and tremendous, explosion, non-scalar growth that explains what McCloskey calls the great enrichment, as well as the difficulties associated with world management of globalization, which led to the discontent kind of idea. And so I think Hayek is very much alive, but it's not his conclusions that are so important as much as his way of reasoning, his way of framing questions in the social sciences.
Let's talk about, you say there were four great phases in his kind of economic growth over the course of his his century as a thinker. And the first three are the ones that you really go through. Let's talk about those. The first phase, you say, can be termed, and this roughly is Hayek writing from about 1920 to 1945,
yeah,
economics as a coordination problem. What is the essential Hayekian insight there, and what was he trying to achieve in this period?
So it's during this period of time that I think you see Hayek developing a deeper understanding of how the institutions, the legal and political and social institutions within which economic activity takes place, play such a vital role in structuring not only just the incentives that economic actors face, but the knowledge that they're able to process, utilize, discover, grow. In a lot of ways, Hayek, like his friend Popper and others, is a growth of knowledge thinker. And so it's how alternative institutional environments are either conducive or, hinder the growth of knowledge. And that growth of knowledge is essential for coordinating of plans. And in the early period of time, the puzzle that really captured his imagination was how it is that economic activity is coordinated through time. And so his original work in economics was on what's called the imputation problem. And that's a kind of a technical term in economics. Mm-hmm. But what it really means is, how is it that a farmer who's raising pigs can in fact figure out how to price the pigs and the resources that go to maintaining the pigs, in order for the final goods that those pigs go to satisfy, which is, let's say, ham sandwiches or, mm-hmm, pork chops or whatever, right? And so how do you coordinate that? Because I have to invest today in an imagined future demand for those resources. And when tastes change, I'm going to have some mechanism that means that I'll adapt and reallocate my resources back here. And so it's that puzzle and the complexity of that puzzle, which completely, you know, engrossed Hayek in the early 20s and then led to his study of business cycles. And then eventually even the problems with efforts to regulate the price system or to abolish the price system.
So this, and part of what's going on here is that in the 19th century, as you were talking about, obviously, you know, there, I mean, it's an infinite, every year, every day, every minute is kind of an infinite store of questions and things you can be asked. But you mentioned Deirdre McCloskey and her discussion of the Great Enrichment. One of the things that really happened in the 19th century is that suddenly we went from Europe or North America went from a subsistence economy into a surplus economy where there was more stuff, more people could buy and sell more stuff, more people could live. What was the role of prices, property, profit, and loss kind of as institutions that led to that surplus in the first place?
Well, I mean, you got to be complicated, you know, got to be subtle about this because as McCloskey points out, you know, you could have the formal adoption of institutions of property both prior to the takeoff and then, of course, after the takeoff. And so you got to watch out that you're not just engaged in spurious correlations, mm-hmm. right? And so McCloskey, in my opinion, offers a combustible combination thesis. She would disagree. She thinks mm-hmm. she's, you know, found the real cause, which is ideas. But my view is that ideas are the spark which within a certain institutional environment lead to the kind of capital accumulation and the expansion of the division of labor and the growth of the economy that gives us this non-scalar. I mean, the big issue with the Great Enrichment is the non-scalar nature, right? If you look at the hockey stick, you know, we're going through time, going through time, going through time. And then what happens is you just go, you know, whoop, like, yeah. you know, it goes way up. It doesn't go on a scalar like I add one and it goes up and add one and it goes up. It's actually a non-scalar. And so the question that draws us our attention is we look at that point and we draw a circle around it and say, like, okay, what's going on mm-hmm. here? And Hayek is coming after that and coming after that conversation that is about those issues, you know, that were done by the great, you know, economists in the late 19th century. And he is trying to articulate the value of those institutions that he believes led to that takeoff to a new audience. And so I think that is critical if you know, the co-development of economic thought and the institutions of British liberalism, private property in the rule of law, those kind of ideas, they're all part and parcel of what it meant to be a classical economist. You know, Lionel Robbins is, sorry for rambling a little bit, but Lionel Robbins has a great book called The Theory of Economic Policy and Classical British Economists. And one of the things he points out is from Adam Smith to John Stuart Mill was that they took as critical the co-evolution of the institutions of liberal government. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that they were ever perfect liberalism. So again, they're constantly modifying, updating mm-hmm. for the very things that you're talking about.
When you say liberal government, say liberal government, what do you mean by that? You mean like the state and maybe not even the state.
Constitutionally restricted right. state.
Right. And, so that individuals have more of a sphere of choosing how to live their lives of activity. And none of this is utopian, but.
Right. So you get autonomy, prosperity, and peace. This mm-hmm. is the goals that they're trying to do. Individual autonomy, the maximum level of it. Participate in a market economy, which allows them to experience generalized prosperity. So the spreading actually of wealth, rather than it concentrated just in the kings and the queens, but instead that it spreads. I mean, you know, this is during this period of time in the 19th century. So yes, of course, there's imperfections. There's all these past imperfections. And what happens, especially among the liberal economists, and this is an important part of the history, it was the liberal economists that were opposed to slavery.
Right.
They were the ones overturned, right? They are the ones who were opposed to colonialism. They were the ones who were saying that liberalism is an emancipation doctrine in which we try to free individuals from the bonds of previous oppression. Now, did they do it perfect? No, of course not. They have restrictions on, you know, voting and all kinds of other things, which in the 20th century we've expanded upon. But the march of liberalism, or the arc of liberalism, is one towards greater and greater expansion of freedoms and freeing of individuals from oppression. I talk about this somewhat at the very end of the book, because that's about reconstruction of liberalism based on Hayekianism for us today, as opposed to, you know, trying to treat Hayek as the source book,
right?
Where I go to the Constitution of Liberty and say, what were the policies that Hayek believed? That's not what I'm trying to do. It's like, what does a Hayekianism lead us to think about in terms of the flexibility and coherence of institutions that allow for human flourishing?
For Hayek, everything is process. It's really not the results at any given moment. And key to that then is, so you have in the 19th century with the growth of liberalism, which helps industrialism, which helps people get richer. By the 20s, when he's writing, or he's really first coming onto the scene in a big way, economics had become, and you talk about this, economics as a coordination problem, that the main debate that Hayek was in was with, I guess, socialists who took for granted a certain level of wealth that could then be redistributed. And he's saying it's a little bit more complicated than
right.
that.
So his friends, I think this is the key thing to understand Hayek's position, which is that he comes to the LSE with great fanfare. The British economy, like the economies in Europe in general, are suffering through the Great Depression. And so economic stagnation is on the minds of everyone. Or to go back to the coordination theme, malcoordination or miscoordination. Ships are passing each other in the night all the time in economics here.
And so people are producing too much of certain things and not enough of others.
Seems
like nothing quite is adding up.
And so everyone is trying to figure out what's going on, right? And Hayek comes there and he gives an explanation that is based on basic economic reasoning, going back to sort of your nature of price signals, the role that price signals play in the economy as guides to production and exchange activity, the lure of profit, the penalty of loss. And he attracts a very big audience. People are like, oh my God, Hayek is this young star economist. And so he gets involved at the LSE. He and Lionel Robbins developed this seminar. It becomes famous. They have visitors from all over the world. The 1930s are these years of high theory. They're the main opponents to the people in Cambridge who are called the Cambridge Circus, which is Joan Robinson and John Maynard Keynes and others. And what happens is that by the end of the 1930s, Hayek and Robbins are no longer viewed as a strong rival after the general theory becomes published. One of the reasons is that Robbins himself goes to work in the government as an economist. Hayek has his students, and they are his students, people like Abel Lerner and whatnot, start writing about using the very same tools that Hayek used to now defend market socialism. And so Hayek's colleagues and students at the LSE are now arguing that we are socialists in our economics because we're liberal in our politics.
And that means, dilate on that for a second? That means they believe in things like, broad prosperity and inclusion and more people having more opportunities to live full lives. And they want to use kind of capitalist economics to spread the wealth around?
Well, they want to use the mechanisms of the market to serve the goals of 19th century socialism,
right?
Solidarity, fraternity, justice, equality, these kind of things, right? And they believe that they also value liberalism. So they're not totalitarians, in the same sense. So they're not making an argument about bourgeois democracy and these other kind of things. And so Hayek is saying to them, look, you guys are sounding an awful lot like what I just heard when I was hanging out in Vienna close to 20 years ago, right after the war. And that the consequences of that led to the rise of fascism and whatnot. And so that's why he calls it the road to serfdom. It's a tragedy because the collectivist think that they're going to be able to combine collectivist economics with democracy and liberal values. But the tragedy is that by giving over economic control, they end up by ceding the political liberties, right? And that's what leads to the road to serfdom. And so Hayek offers a warning. But before that, he tries to figure out, you know, as part of that project, that's a conclusion of his project. But part of that is what he's doing is he's thinking to himself, okay, why are these people being led astray? What's going on? And so what happens is he makes a move at the end of the 1930s, both in an institutional direction, that institutions have to be more in the forefront of our analysis in economics rather than just in the background. And we have to talk about that, and also philosophical, because we have to understand why philosophically institutions were being disregarded, right?
And by institutions, you mean things like the rule of law, private property rights, explain a little bit what you mean by institutions, because so economists talk a lot about how, and partly, if not chiefly, because of Hayek, institutions matter. But what does that mean?
So the broad brush definition of institutions is just the social rules of the game, mm-hmm. and their enforcement. And those rules of the game can come in formal rules and informal rules. And so that's why it's important, I think, to stress that it's not just the rule of law and private property. That's kind of a key one. But there also are, political, legal, and social morals that are associated with this, because certain attitudes and beliefs, this goes back to McCloskey point that we were making, right, about that certain attitudes and beliefs about, like, say, trade and what McCloskey refers to as giving it a go, and that's going to be encouraged now as opposed to being viewed as suspect behavior, that makes enforcing of those institutions lower cost.
This is part of the liberal project, right? Not simply that we say, okay, the government doesn't get to, stop people importing or exporting corn or textiles or setting the prices, but also part of the liberal project is a mindset that is talking about kind of openness, toleration, pluralism, the willingness not to immediately to try to shut down anything that is new or different. And I guess McCloskey also talks about how people within the system committed to a system in which they would not necessarily come out, in a business environment, for instance, they're going to lay open markets where they might end up losing their shirt, but they're okay with that.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they're okay with it.
Yeah, they'll live with it.
The society is okay with it, and encourages the idea of risk taking and entrepreneurship as opposed to security and safety or whatever. But I think that one of the key issues to keep in mind about the liberal project is, as you pointed out, this issue of toleration and of dissent. Mm-hmm. And the idea of openness, entrepreneurship in a significant way is an act of dissent. You're trying to do something different than what it currently is done. And so you're breaking the traditions. You're snapping out of the current forms of things. And with that there's costs associated with that, like any kind of new move. But there's also these tremendous benefits of opening up the world to possibilities that previously weren't being pursued. And so a large part of Hayek's idea is how competition is this machinery, not only for the efficient allocation of resources, which is how most economists talk about it, but competition is this procedure for discovering what is currently unknown. Mm-hmm. It's actually through that process that we now discover new possibilities that previously we were completely unaware of.
Right. And who knew we needed personal computers, or that we wanted personal computers until they suddenly became essential to our everyday life?
Yeah, and let alone the smartphones that we carry around that are an evolution of that. And who would have thought we'd be able to do this? As I use a line in my book where I say that Hayek, could not have imagined, just it wouldn't even have come as a part of his imagination that we'd be walking around with cell phones that would have the collected works of F.A. Hayek on them.
Right. So the first phase you talk about was, that he was dealing with was economics as a coordination problem. And he's trying to explain why, I guess, in the 20s and 30s, or when he started writing, when the Depression hits, when all kinds of bad things happen, there is a growth among even liberal people with liberal beliefs, but they say, with economics, if we had enough power or if we had enough knowledge, we could figure out how to say, okay, well, you want X number of pigs to be grown in 1939 because that's what the demand is going to be. We're smart enough. We just have to figure out how to coordinate stuff. And Hayek is saying it's much more complicated than that, that there's just not enough knowledge in the world, and that once you start to cede control of economics or of your personal life to rulers, that it's going to end poorly.
I was just going to say, I think it's important to keep in mind that, he's trying to wrestle with the zeitgeist of the time, which is that markets suffer from inherent instability. They suffer from inherent inefficiencies. This is the rise of market failure theory and monopoly power. And they suffer from injustice, right? So you have instability, inefficiency, and injustice.
Right.
And Hayek is trying to explain how markets properly, organized within the right institutional environment don't get rid of those problems. I mean, that would be a huge mistake to claim that, the Jedi mind trick in economics, there is no problems. What he tries to do instead is to say markets serve as these vehicles that ameliorate these sharp edges. They don't eliminate the sharp edges, but they ameliorate them. So markets might fail, but use the market to fix the failure. Today's failure, today's inefficiency is tomorrow's profit opportunity for the entrepreneur who knows how to act on that inefficiency. And what happens in a lot of the economics that's rising up at the time is that it's excessively formalistic and excessively aggregative. And because of those two problems, it's excessive aggregation and it's excessive formalism, it clouds our ability to see the dynamic adjustment process of the market that's guided by prices.
And the market then is a process, and it both exposes error. I mean, it has, errors come suddenly, once something becomes really profitable, a lot of people flood into it, it gets overproduced, and then you realize you didn't really want it anyway. But his point is that markets help you correct that. They help you. It's a process by which you can get back on track.
Right. Well, these prices are so adaptability. So what happens with Hayek is markets, what matters for Hayek is not the static efficiency of markets, but the dynamic adjustment of markets guided by prices.
The discovery process, because he's coming out of an intellectual tradition of the Austrian School of Economics, which is focused on subjectivism, or the idea that each of us, individuals have different wants. We value different things at different levels, at different times in our lives. And then what the market does is it kind of equilibrates all of this stuff into something that's not total chaos.
Right. The virus gets fed, as Bastiat used to say. Yeah.
And then, by the end of, obviously, and as you peg it, it's about 1920 to 1945. Obviously, fascism in many ways, as well as economic planning in liberal economies, was a way to say, okay, yeah, let's get rid of the injustice. Let's get rid of this inefficiency where you have a lot of people doing the same thing when they could be doing this or that. There's these, even ironically, after World War II and the defeat of at least of the Nazis, there's an embrace of, if not quite total institutions, but this idea that there are certain people who are very smart, or certain institutions who can, kind of direct and control, regulate where we're going as a society. And you talk about the second phase of his career. And here you you say this is stuff he was working on basically between 1940 and 1960, the Abuse of Reason Project.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what was Hayek, you know, what was he doing and what was he critiquing during the Abuse of Reason Project period of his intellectual life?
So I think that you hit the nail on the head. What happens in the 20th century is that you end up by having this strange alliance that is embodied in the progressive attitude, which is an alliance between statism or the managerial state and the intellectual elites. So economics is transformed from a science of social understanding to a science of social control. And Hayek is agitating against that. And he doesn't understand why his colleagues don't have the humility that previous people in economics taught, that economics was primarily provide us with negative knowledge as opposed to positive knowledge.
And by that, you mean it allows us to look back and see patterns or understand why certain things happen, but it really doesn't. You know, nobody has the ability to say in 2024, we're going to need X number of widgets. So let's get cracking on that.
Let alone a bureaucrat who's going to stand on top of this and make these decisions. And, you know, Adam Smith, for example, just to capture what I was trying to say in terms of the transformation, if you look at Adam Smith, he argues not only in the theory of moral sentiments about the man of systems and his arrogance in his conceit that he could, you know, move people around like so many pieces on a chessboard. But also in The Wealth of Nations, he says that you can't trust this kind of power to no Senate or no lawgiver whatsoever, and that it's nowhere as dangerous as in the hands of a man who has the presumption that he, in fact, can rule over others. So in many ways, what Hayek is standing for, like the older classical political economists, was that we're going to see a system in which we govern with rather than govern over. But in the 20th century, the progressive ideology was one that, starting with Wilson and continuing on, you know, Wilson in the United States, you can go over into Britain and you can, you know, look at that as well. And the idea here was that you're going to have trained experts that are going to, based on science and reason, will be able to govern the economy appropriately or govern society appropriately. And so you have this alliance between this managerial statism and scientism, the belief that I now have the laws of science on my side to be able to then, you know, rationally engineer society. And Hayek is cutting against that. And so he's trying to blow that up. So it's called the Abuse of Reason because he says he's going to use reason to whittle down the claims of reason.
Which is a line straight out of David Hume as well, that, you know, the idea that if you really understand how reason works and rationality works, you want to take it down a notch because you're going to fall into error. But let me push back. And this is not even talking about the large debate, the geopolitical debate between socialism or not socialism, communism in the Soviet Union, and that sort of like total planning versus what we're talking about in the United States is stuff that, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith might be considered like one of the most cogent articulators of a new industrial state or of a managerial state, where it's like, we're going to soften the edges of capitalism. We're going to minimize the ups and downs, and we're going to make sure that everybody gets a piece of the pie. Isn't that partly what happened after World War II, though, when the managers came in, whether they were at the U.S. Department of Agriculture or at General Motors?
Right. So I think that you have a couple of debates that Hayek is involved in. One of them is the debate with hard socialism. That's like what you were talking about with totalitarianism. And then he has a second round of the debate, which is on the issue of what you could call soft socialism, which in many ways is just the administrative state. And those are different arguments. One argument in the first case is that you can't actually achieve what it is that you set out to achieve, but you try to achieve it anyway. And so what happens is you end up in this metamorphosis of the system, which is ugly compared to anyone who looks at it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's like the road to serfdom. You end up in a system that ends up by entrapping you in slavery in a way that you could never have imagined since you thought you were going to get this new freedom. On the other hand, the administrative state means that what you have is you have a state which causes periodic difficulties in the economy that prevents the adjustment process from fully working to the extent that it can, that you get a bloated state, that you get inefficiencies in the sense that unintended consequences of say, for example, the war on poverty, you end up by spending more and more dollars and getting less and less improvements. And so this is where the Galbraithian new administrative state runs into the Hayekian criticism, is that, you know, you got to remember is that Galbraith was advocating that in the 50s and 60s. By the 1970s, right, you have a complete this frustration with that system, right? So if we would have frozen time and just talked about the intentionalities of the system, you know, you would have looked in the Kennedy administration and Camelot and all of that, and you would have said, oh, look at how great we're doing. You know, look, we got the best and the brightest, McNamara's in charge, you know, and everything like that. And then fast forward 10 years, you got the Vietnam War. You have, you know, going off the Vietnam War, you then run into what? You end up running into then the stagflation of the 70s, mm-hmm. you know, all of that. And so.
Well, and Hayek also pointed out that in these organizations that there was a human cost to this too, right? That, you know, working within one of these mega structures, whether it was the Pentagon or IBM or AT&T or General Motors, that there was something distinctly existentially unsatisfying for the individuals trapped in those systems.
It's actually an ironic thing. I don't talk about much in the book, but people that are critics of Hayek or critics of Buchanan or whatever, they often miss the kind of radicalism of those people that are consistent with the values that they have. So, for example, Hayek is actually quite a strong critic of corporations and the protections that the state provides to corporations. And Buchanan was a radical critic of inherent wealth. I mean, he was an advocate of 100% inheritance tax. Now, I might disagree with aspects of what Hayek and Buchanan argue and how they argue it and why they argue it. But the reality is you have to understand the positions and where they're coming from and why they think those positions are actually consistent with their liberalism that as they understood it. And so that's what I find frustrating in the secondary literature criticizing some of these thinkers, is because they fail to they have a caricature of these thinkers and they don't really wrestle with the reality of these thinkers.
And I mean, because they're people typically on the left, but they want to see people like Hayek and Buchanan as apologists for power and for the status quo and for both the kind of aggregation of wealth in individual hands, but then the maintaining that against all comers. And what you're saying is that when you actually look at people like Hayek, he's talking about a completely different project. I mean, it's really about giving more space to individuals to figure out who they are and what they want to do.
Hayek is not a champion of increasing GDP. Right. So it's not, you don't eat growth rates. He's all about trying to do human flourishing. What are the institutional environments that allow for individuals to live flourishing lives, to live their life not subjected to discrimination nor subject to domination? Hayek is trying to find that set of institutional environment, that set of institutional pattern, that subject individuals neither to discrimination nor to domination. And that's his liberalism. That's why he stresses this generality norm You know, in all of his ideas, that is, no law shall benefit one group without benefiting all other groups. If all you can demonstrate is that a law benefits one particular group, that's called privileges. Hayek is against privileges. That's why he doesn't like legislation. He thinks it's a vehicle for privileges rather than law, which is the general notion of it. And so all of that has to be – now, you could argue that he has wrong – arguments, right? Like that actually would be a fruitful conversation that, look, Hayek has inconsistencies because he wants to have this constitutionally, you know, protected sphere, which is follows a generality norm. But in order to operationalize it, he has to actually have some form of privileges. And then the whole system, you know, suffers from an internal dynamic problem. That could be an interesting conversation. But that's not the conversation that the critics have with Hayek. They have a caricature of Hayek and they go from there.
Yeah, let's get to that in a second. But because now we're talking about the, you know, the third great phase of his life that you're talking about. And she says the period between about 1960 and 1980 when he, and I'm quoting from you, transitioned to a third phase of intellectual inquiry, the restatement of the liberal principles of justice. Hayek articulates the importance of general rules, which is obviously part of the Red Serfdom, but also in things like the Constitution of Liberty and later talk. So, you know, one of the things that Hayek is often held up now, and, you know, he's been dead for a long time. He was a Nobel Prize winner and he's got some great quotes. And he's held up as this kind of dry, dusty piece of paper, either as a caricature to be attacked, a straw man to be burned, or as a champion to contemporary libertarians who say, you know, what he got right was that, you know, a little bit of planning leads to a lot of planning. The bad always get on top. Talk about he also stressed, though, that every generation has to reinvent liberalism or restate it in a way that makes it almost a utopian ideal of that we can do better, we can have a freer society, et cetera. How does he articulate that, and is it a compelling vision?
Yeah, so let me just actually read the quote. He says, if the old truths are to retain their hold on men's minds, they must be restated in the language and concepts of successive generations. What at one time are their most effective expressions gradually become so worn with use that they cease to carry a definitive meaning. The underlying ideas may be valid as ever, but the words, even when they refer to problems that are still with us, no longer convey the same conviction. The arguments do not move in a context familiar to us, and they rarely give us direct answers to questions we are asking. And so this is why this is why liberals have to constantly reinvent and the evolution of the argument. Now, Mises also made this argument, which people tend to forget. These guys did not have a catechism that they tried to force you to solve a new dogma. They had a framework of thinking about the world, which is constantly evolving and changing. And the idea was, again, greater and greater scopes of freedom for individuals, less oppression from all kinds of forms of oppression. So, you know, overcoming, that's what it means to liberalize something. We understand that when we use the standard word, liberalizing us, you know, liberalizing us against the dogma of our background, liberalizing us against, you know, the dogma of our religion, liberalizing us from the restrictions on our activities. Liberalizing marriage, you know, so now we can marry whoever the hell we want to marry rather than the idea of what the church told us is the only way
in contemporary libertarian arguments, this often sometimes comes up as the argument between thin and thick libertarianism, and the thin libertarian say, you know, libertarianism or liberalism is only a philosophy of the relationship between the individual and the government or the individual and the state. The thick libertarians are, you know, kind of talking about what you're saying, that, you know, there is a broad temperament that goes along with anything having to do with specific laws regulating, the size, scope, and spending of government. Hayek, then, is clearly a thick libertarian in this context.
Well, I mean, I think he is a product of his age. So you have to remember that, you know, he has certain traditional values that he thinks are vital glue that hold society together. And so he might make pronouncements on certain aspects of that. But the general thrust of his work, Hayekianism, which is different from Hayek himself, but Hayekianism pushes in a direction in which individuals and their projects become what you create is the institutions that give scope for that. So that individuals have the freedom to pursue their projects as they see fit. And so I think that one of the real problems in modern libertarianism is I think a lot of people got it wrong here. They think it's a marketing problem. We just have to market, you know, too bad we don't have folk songs for libertarianism, except for Rush or something like that, right? But that's not the problem. The problem is that a lot of libertarians were attracted by the architectonic system that, say, you know, someone like Rand laid out or Rothbard laid out for them, and they think of it as a comprehensive system, and as opposed to an ongoing evolution of a set of arguments within a broader framework. And then they thought it was a cute game to play to try to derive logically from those axioms what would be the most obnoxious behavior possible individually to hold, to then take as a litmus test. So I have the right to be a jerk, right? But not everyone has to interact with me as being a jerk. But I have a right to be a jerk, and I have a right to do that because this is my private property and this is my individual freedom to do that. And so as a result, they held that up as a litmus test. And if you backed off of it and said, geez, you know, people shouldn't really behave that way towards others, they said, ah, see, you're not really a libertarian. And then they would make fun of you or whatever. And that's a thinking problem. I'm doing this as a caricature,
right?
But I think it's a thinking problem. The alternative was, of course, to just do, you know, whatever the hell you wanted to do and say, I have a right to be left alone to do whatever the hell I want to do. And, you know, that has costs with it, too. You know, so, you know, in a 2016 you know, campaign, you turn on the TV to watch the Libertarian Convention and you got like a clown show going on, you know, and you're like, geez, you know, maybe they should like have recognized that maybe they had a chance to do something more normal and appeal to a broader set of people. That's more of a strategy thing than a belief thing. But I think that this litmus test libertarianism has to be rejected, because what it does, it puts the focus on my ability to say no, which is very important in the history of humanity. The idea of standing up and oppressor saying to you, no, I'm not going to do that.
But no, this is Martin Luther saying, here yes. I stand. I mean, this is
right. So it's a very
Hawthorne, as Melville said, saying no in thunder. It's Henry David Thoreau or Martin Luther King, you know, in jail saying no.
No, I'm not. It's very, very important aspect of it. But I think just as important is the aspect of being able to say yes to opportunities which previously you didn't have, to trade with people that you never would have known, to cross borders, artificial borders, to be able to experience new lives and create new opportunities for yourself. And what liberalism is about is actually like both sides of that equation, saying yes to the possibilities of interactions with people of great social and geographic distance, different language communities, everything like that. And yet at the same time, being able to say no to those who want to rule over you. And so how do you coordinate that requires a set of institutions that enable you to both be able to overcome the grand difficulties of distance, social and geographic distance, so that you're able to actually interact with others, right? But yet at the same time, be able to protect your autonomous sphere so you have the freedom to interact with those others. So I think liberalism becomes this framework that's vital.
So it is a framework as opposed to a catechism. It's a kind of matrix or a decision process rather than the end results. From a Hayekian point of view, let me ask, because the debate over things like gay marriage or same-sex marriage are essentially finished. Even conservatives won't do that. But when that debate, even just a few years ago, was going on, a lot of people would point to Hayek and say, you know, one of the great insights of Hayek was that we disregard institutions that have been built up over time and have proven value because they persist over centuries, if not decades. And so that if you come in and you say, you know what, you know, marriage has been defined as a union between a single man and a single woman for hundreds of years now. And then you just say, okay, well, whoever wants to get married can get married. You are being anti-Hayekian because you're just washing away, you know, this revealed, I mean, you might not be able to articulate why this rule was in place, but it flourished, so it must have some value. How do you square, from a Hayekian perspective, interest in radical social change, as well as entrepreneurial change, with Hayek's embrace of kind of tradition and of, you know, the persistence of norms?
That's a great question. I think that one way to think about that is that what you're capturing is Hayek is saying that we disregard traditional institutions at our peril. But he also wrote, "Why I'm Not a Conservative." And I think that people, listeners, if they want to delve deep into this, need to read both the Why I'm Not a Conservative and also the essay Errors of Constructivism in combination with one another. Because what Hayek is really making in those arguments is a epistemological claim. His argument is that we as social scientists, especially we as true radical liberals, need to question all of society's values. We need to have the freedom to question all of those society's values. But what his argument is that epistemologically, we cannot question all of those values at once. We always question on the margin. We have to take as a given background, you know, most of what's going on, and then just pick away at it given this background here. We don't have an Archimedean point by which we can stand on top and attack all of society's values at once. And so that could lead to gradualism, maybe, but maybe not, right? This is one of the real tensions or questions that we have to wrestle with in Hayek's thought. It could actually, because remember, he's also calling for being the true radical liberal, which is that you genuinely are trying to overturn the institutions that are bonds of oppression. And so how do you sort out from that? That's the $64 million question. Right?
Yeah. Which, of course, in 2018 dollars is the $64 question or something like that, right? Depending on when you... So, one of the critiques of Hayek...
I felt a little bad just, when I just said that $64 million, yeah. I feel like in the
hyperinflation.
Movie... No, but it's in the movie, the Austin Powers movie.
Yes,
when he
that's
comes
right.
back and he says $1 million, you
right.
know, like that. Yeah. So yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, Hayek seems to have won a wide following among contemporary conservatives. He is becoming more and more of a villain of the contemporary left, of the progressive left, and. Who rightly point out that towards the end of his life, he defended Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and he was not always particularly good. I mean, you mentioned in some of his particular, policy pronouncements, but also in his endorsements or political commitments. How, and you're talking, liberalism or libertarianism, I'm going to lasso you into my push to turn libertarian less into a noun and more as an adjective. And Michael Munger at Duke has talked about it as a direction rather than as particular destination and all of that kind of stuff. But what is your answer to the people who say, look, this is a guy who, loved one of the most loathsome dictators in recent memory and who is a reactionary, actually, that he's not forward-looking when it comes to making people freer?
Look, I mean, first, I make a distinction in the book between Hayek the man versus Hayekianism, and I don't want to be in the business of defending Hayek the man. I want to be in the business of talking and articulating what Hayekianism as a research program promises us in the social sciences and the humanities. But I will say, and I think this is, you have to be very, very careful on these pronouncements, both of Mises and of Hayek making pronouncements, and Friedman for that matter, making pronouncements in their lifetime about things. The first thing I would like to point out about Hayek is he was never a paid consultant for any of these regimes, Thatcher or Pinochet. He was an old man when Pinochet was there. He relied on the judgment of people that were on the ground that told him things. You have the Allende regime. So look, there's a really good paper by Bruce Caldwell and Leon Montes who talk about the context of Hayek's statements and why it is that, you know, he made the kind of statements he has. But he, just like Friedman, you know, he literally met with these people in the context of a conference in which he gave the same speech he would give at any right. place. You know, Friedman gave a speech that said, you double the money supply, you're going to double the price level. And he would give that speech in Santiago, Chile, or he'd give it in Newark, New Jersey. Or as he always liked to point out, he gave it in China.
Right.
And no one ever complained about when he did it in China, which was, in fact, a very ruthless regime that he said the same thing. It wasn't, you know, the China, you know, under Deng Xiaoping that he gave it. It's before that. Right. And then he gives this reform.
And this is odd. I mean, there's always a certain moral outrage that's selective, both on the right and the left. I mean, people constantly Joe Stiglitz is, I don't think he's any libertarian idea of a great economist necessarily, but he's a. You know, he said good things about Hugo Chavez. It cuts in all different directions.
Yeah,
Google just said that it doesn't want to work with the U.S. Pentagon, but it's more than happy to help the Chinese government censor, you know, the internet. So it's like there's always selective outrage.
Yeah, and it's very complicated issues because as an academic who goes to a lot of different countries, I started my career studying post-communism, right? And you end up by, you know, showing up in these environments. They take pictures of you, and the next thing you know, you're sitting next to someone who is like a regional governor. You have no idea who they, you know, they're not.
Well, this is the Rosalind Carter, John Wayne Gacy photo that haunts the youth of, or haunts the memory of those of us of a certain age, right? Where you don't know who you're
sitting next to. I don't want to excuse him.
Yeah.
Because I think there's importance to do critical genealogies, but I think it's important to also, when doing critical genealogies, to put ideas in context to understand, you know, what's going on. These guys, like Hayek, was not someone who worked for the World Bank. He didn't work for the WTO. He didn't work for the IMF. He wasn't he wasn't at the Council of Economic Advisors. Mm-hmm. He's an academic philosopher, political economist, who was asked questions in the abstract about the relationship between democracy and liberalism. And he just simply said, look, in theory, we could have, you know, a liberal authoritarian, right? Mm-hmm. Or we could have a liberal democracy, or we could have a unconstrained democracy.
Right. An authoritarian democracy.
An authoritarian democracy. And he's like, okay, so which one could I imagine could work here? And, you know, he's going through the logic of that. It's similar to, you know, people get freaked out about Buchanan doing thought experiments. You know, like Buchanan would do a thought experiment, you know, about the nature of trying to wrestle with Leviathan. You know, and so someone is going to be, it's like Nozick's Tale of the Slave. You know, it's a thought experiment that you go through. It's not advocating, you know, that you could be a slave or whatever. He's talking about the different levels in which we think through these things. And sometimes people, you know, do quote marks and ellipses and things like that to capture people saying things that they didn't actually say.
You know, speaking of genealogies, you actually quote at one point Michel Foucault, the French social theorist, who's famous for really kind of talking about the archaeology of knowledge and genealogies, intellectual genealogies. And One of the overlaps between somebody like Foucault, who is widely disliked in what I would say broad libertarian circles, certainly conservative circles, even many leftist circles, because he wasn't sufficiently Marxist or political in many ways. But both Hayek and Foucault, and Foucault towards the end of his life actually asked his students in Paris, this was in the early 80s, to read Hayek and Mises with special care, because he thought that liberalism was one possible way of constraining power over people, over individuals. He ultimately rejected a kind of libertarian, a kind of Hayekian or Misesian understanding of liberalism and whatnot. But is there fertile ground to think about Hayek? And Deirdre McCloskey has written about this. I'm obviously an advocate for it as well. That when you take Hayek seriously about the limits of our knowledge, that he becomes somewhat postmodern, and that doesn't mean that nothing is true or right, that everything is just total subjectivity, but that we benefit when we start to emphasize more the limits of our knowledge rather than the extent of our knowledge and how that might justify our ability to control people.
So I think that it's important to distinguish between postmodernism and deconstructionism, as you just did. And in that postmodernist epistemology, in many ways, is sort of mirrors post-positivist epistemology, and Hayek is clearly a post-positivist.
Explain what that means, especially in the context of, I suspect that if a lot of people listening to this and a lot of economists, if they think about positivism or in a more reduced form, they're thinking about an essay by Milton Friedman about economics as a positive science. What do you mean by post-positivism?
So first there, let me go back a little bit, try to do this quickly, but there is a sense in which positive economics versus normative economics is valuable to keep in mind, a what is versus what should be kind of distinction. And Max Weber, at the turn of the 20th century, came up with tools for conversation such that people across ideological divides could talk to each other rather than just scream at each other. And he argued that what we needed to do was treat ends as given and restrict our discussion to the effectiveness of means to the attainment of those ends that others are pursuing. And that very much influenced the way that Ludwig von Mises approached his economics. It also very much influenced the way Hayek approaches his economics. It's one of the reasons why he dedicates The Road to Serfdom to socialists of all parties. He wants to have a shared, strong understanding of what is the good, and then analyzes the institutional pattern suggested by those to see whether or not it can achieve the good or whether or not it achieves consequences which are the opposite of what you hope to achieve. That's why it's called The Road to Serfdom, rather than The Road to Freedom, which is what they were hoping to get. And that's positive economics prior to positivism. By the time you get to Friedman, his way in which he translates the Vienna Circle unity of science approach is that what demarcates science from non-science is that you submit your hypotheses to tests in empirical tests. So you build models. They generate certain propositions. You submit those propositions to tests. And unless you're doing that, you're not doing science. You're doing something else. And so that is a different kind of argument than what Hayek and Mises were making about positive economics. And that became Friedman and Samuelson. Samuelson was about excessive formalization, and Friedman is about excessive empiricism. And that became the sort of standard way in which economists practiced the art of doing economics from, say, 1950s to the 1980s. You mentioned Deirdre McCloskey before. Deirdre's move from economic history into economic philosophy was her effort to what she called the rhetoric of economics, which was to import from philosophy and the criticism of this Friedman-Samuelson program, and to show that even Friedman and Samuelson-type research relied nevertheless on various tools of persuasion, which belie the idea of model empirical test.
Right. So, okay?
So Deirdre tries to force economics to have a postmodernist moment in the 1980s. Hayek, sorry for talking over you, but just Hayek started this kind of change already in the 1950s with a counter-revolution of science, in which he argues, and I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier or before, but the earlier way in which Hayek and Mises saw their distinctiveness was that they were going to focus on the sciences of human action, which was focused on human purposes and plans versus disciplines that are not dealing with human purposes and plans. And so there was a difference between methodological dualism of the human sciences and the natural sciences. That which turned on the humanness of the subject of our studies. But by later in life, Hayek switches away from that more to focus on simple phenomena and complex phenomena. And it's the sciences of complexity that is the distinguishing characteristic of why the simple methodological notion of positivism that Friedman has is not going to be applicable to the sciences of complexity. And therefore, we needed a different kind of methodology. And so it's that context in which Hayek is stressing the social nature of our epistemology. And so the difference between Hayek and deconstructionist is that Hayek, I would argue, is an ontological realist. Okay. So he believes that there is, you know, Samuel Johnson's rock, right? You know, there is a real world, but he doesn't believe that we have straight access to it. And so he's an epistemological contextualist. The way we learn is constantly in this context and trapped in the context of our times and the debates that we're having with other people, and that's the only way that we in fact get approximations to figuring out what that rock is. And so he is a postmodernist in that sense. There's an old essay by Gary Madison, who's a philosopher from Canada. I think he's passed away now. Not sure about that, but I think that's true. But Gary on Hayek and his postmodernism, and it's stressing this idea of subject, what you stressed before, subjectivism, interpretation, these kind of issues.
How and maybe we'll end on this then. How Hayek in many ways is, you know, he's a heavyweight champion. You know, if he's not quite Muhammad Ali, he's you know, he's up. He's Larry Holmes at the very least. Yeah. And yet people like Bruce Caldwell, who you've mentioned, whose book from about 15 years ago, Hayek's Challenge, ended, you know, saying that Hayek ultimately is, you know, arguably the most important economist and possibly social thinker of a good chunk of the past 50-100 years, has had little institutional impact on the practice of economics or on the way we think about things. Can you summarize, like, do you agree with that? Or in what ways has Hayek radically transformed either the academic pursuit of economics or a more general understanding of how best we can go about making our way in the world, particularly towards the liberal ends of autonomy and independence and opportunity and justice?
So I think that Hayek has had a kind of a strange fate. So one of the things that you have to keep in mind is, and I try to demonstrate this in the book, is that his career has an arc, and it fits a Jungian archetype because he has a meteoric rise, a crashing defeat, and then a resurrection. And so as a result, people pay attention to Hayek even when they don't like him. He's a critic. They want to criticize him, or they love him, and they, you know, do that. But both the critics and the friends don't actually study him. And so what happened? His books became coffee table books, right? They, you know, you get the Constitution of Liberty, and you sit it there, and then you say, "Ah, see, I read Hayek or whatever." But you don't actually study it. You don't view it as an ongoing research program. And his ideas, in that sense, that Caldwell develops, and I try to, in following Caldwell, try to also develop in this book, those are still promising because they haven't been exhausted scientifically yet. But yet Hayek's recognition should not be doubted. I mean, it's not like both he and Mises For example, we're famous economists in their age. You know, we, as people like you and I, from our perspective, a large part of it is we tell a story about these thinkers, which isn't actually borne out in reality, but it fits nicely with us, which is our favorite thinkers weren't paid attention to. You got to pay attention to our favorite thinkers. Our favorite thinkers were, in fact, superstars in the discipline. They were, you know, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson, you know, kind of idea. Mises is a distinguished fellow of the American Economic Association. You don't give that away like candy. You know, Hayek was a Nobel Prize winner, but also, you know, won the highest, was made a fellow of the British Academy, you know, when he was a youngster, you know, actually, and all these kind of things. These guys are superstars in the world of ideas. Now, but the idea is that Hayek's program, in my estimation, hasn't been developed because people didn't take this institutional epistemic seriously. When they tried to operationalize the research program, because it was still constrained by the Friedman-Samuelson methodology in economics, what was easier to operationalize was incentive institutionalism. So I'm going to bring property rights in, and I'm going to be able to talk about the costs and benefit structures. I'm going to bring politics in. I'm going to be talking about the costs and benefit structures. All right. I'm going to bring in law, and I'm going to be able to talk about benefit and costs and benefit structures. But what they didn't talk about is how is it that individuals come to know what those costs and benefits are that they're doing these calculations with. And that was Hayek's point. And part of it is that during his evolution of his arguments, we didn't yet have tools that would satisfy the bar scientifically, I'm putting that in quotes,
right,
that would capture those issues, because the mathematics of the time was limited to a different kind of constraints. It had tool constraints. Where did we start branching out? Well, one of them is Vernon Smith's experiments. Now, all of a sudden, we could use an experiment. We could simulate what the market process could result, even though we couldn't put that down in a simultaneous equation system, right? The experiment gave us the adjustment of the market to market clearing within three rounds of the experiment, or the development of complex adaptive modeling systems like with computer science and whatnot. And so now all of a sudden we're able to start seeing how agents within the model learn, you know, how they learn how to go forward. You know, there's a great story on this with regard to, I'm going to get it wrong probably, but, you know, your listeners can listen to it, which is actually when they were trying to program in the last Lord of the Rings, the CGI, the battle scene, they were trying to get they were using complex adaptive modeling, right? And so they were trying to get the different, you know, orcs and the horses to be able to attack the way that, you know, you would have them in unison, so they would smash into each other. But, you know, the standard paradox of revolution is that the agents, if they're rational, what they need to do, what they want to do is they want to run away, right? So rather than run in unison, they'd start running away because they don't want to get killed in the story, right? But yet somehow, in order to have the battle be able to fight, to increase their chances collectively of surviving, they have to stay together and hold the line, right? And how do you model that? They had all kinds of problems. Well, that's what happens in social science. We see the tensions, we see the difficulties, and that opens up these questions. And so to me, this is what Hayek is all about. And in that sense, he captures the essence of the scientific attitude as reflected in Richard Feynman's, you know, point, which is that Feynman always said, I'd much rather ask questions that I can't answer than ever provide an answer that can't be questioned. And that, to me, is what Hayek's whole project is about. He's getting us to ask questions and think about things that we might not have all the answers for, but those questions are so beautiful for us to ask. And he's never about trying to give us answers that you can never question. And so that's what liberalism is about. That's the attitude, that's the spirit, and that's what needs to happen in the future.
Do you think that that Hayekian understanding of liberalism is up to the, and I guess every moment it's like this, and it seems particularly odd now. For instance, you know, it was recently reported that half of the world's population, half of the globe's population for the first time has something like a middle class or higher living standard. At the same time, we are going apeshit crazy in the West in particular and in America about, you know, declining opportunities and, you know, student loan and credit card debt, et cetera. There's a revival of interest in socialism, at least as a name. What right. The content of that isn't quite clear. Do you think Hayek provides that ability to kind of resuscitate liberalism and get us to focus then? I mean, if we agree on certain broad goals that people should have a lot of autonomy in their lives, that people should be treated equally, that the worst outcome should be avoided or people can be helped. Hayek obviously was always a proponent of a social welfare state, that certain types of the people, certain libertarians you're talking about, you know, that they write him out of the movement as a terrible statist because he believed in Social Security or something. Do you think he provides the most fertile ground then for conversations with, broadly speaking, you know, people who have liberal ends, but then might be confused about the way to get there?
Right. I think that's how I would view it. Hayekianism, I think Hayek's name to some extent serves as a barrier to a lot of these people because he's been, you know, branded in a certain way, which I think is unfair. But I think that if you can communicate what Hayekian liberalism, what true radical liberalism is, it is especially attractive to the curious youth and those. I mean, one of the problems that I have in the way that I see what's going on campuses is not the pain that people have. I think, you know, there's a great quote by James Baldwin, which says that nothing is more deplorable than dismissing other people's pains, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that actually, you know, if people are angry, these young kids are angry, they're upset, you know, we need to listen to them. We need to engage in active listening, like what's going on. But I think a Hayekian analysis would actually, or, you know, would promise for them a world in which their curiosity could be unleashed. You just got to get it. Tap into their curiosity about how the world operates and get them to think that no one has all the right answers. It's one thing if you believe you have truth with a capital T in politics. It's a very short step from that to tyranny. Eliminate truth with a capital T in politics, and all we have is discussion, deliberation, compromise, and agreement. And when you start from that point of view, then what is the framework within which that kind of discourse can take place, which governing with rather than governing over can actually be institutionalized? That is the liberal project that Hayek has in mind. That is a liberal order which is constrained to exhibit neither discrimination nor dominion. And when you have that kind of framework, that allows individuals with wildly different opinions to yet play out against one another, and we learn from each other rather than trying to demand my truth wins out over your truth, and therefore I have the right to impose my truth on you. And to me, this is the problem of our age that we have to wrestle with. That, and unfortunately, because of the things that you mentioned earlier, we've had a discrediting of science because of an overzealousness of scientism. But yet there also is this need for us to understand what you just said, like basic facts about the world. For example, the whole issue having to do with the decline in abject poverty in the world, or the rise of the middle class, or the opportunities that people are confronted with. And going back to the old argument about means and ends, like that some ends, while worthy and desirable, the chosen means that a lot of people try to throw in there are inconsistent with those those ends. Wishing it so doesn't make it so, right? And so we have to have sober analysis to fit in there. And so to me, Hayek, as an economist, as a political economist, and as a social philosopher, offers for us a promise for a political economy for the 21st century, which could be robust against all these challenges. But it's a project that needs to be unfolding, not a project that is already completed.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Pete Bettke. Thank you so much, Pete, for talking.
Thank you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes or Google Play or at Reason.com and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.